It's the Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, who's back tomorrow. And here's a weird thing. Researchers are now finding that we are the product of an ancient genetic fusion between divergent human populations. What does that mean? There used to be this missing link or ghost ancestry in what we understood about human evolution, but that is beginning to change with the help of our guest, Aaron Ragsdale. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. And we're taking a look at the university's role in our evolution of the understanding of human evolution. If you've got questions, so do I, but you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. And Aaron, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
It's wonderful to be here.
I want to start with what we have come to understand prior to your research about human evolution and what human evolution, how we used to understand how we got to where we are today in terms of our ancient ancestry and our genetics.
Yeah, so I think it kind of, well, this is a question that goes back many decades, many centuries, really. People have always been interested in our origins and our evolutionary history.
Where did we come from? Someplace in Africa is where we all emanated from, right?
Yeah, and actually the understanding of the recent African origins of our species is actually quite recent. Even until the 80s and 90s, this was debated. There were kind of competing hypotheses about who were the ancestors of people who live around the world today? Where did we come from? How are we connected? Genetic data really was kind of the thing that really nailed it down, that we're all kind of relatively closely related and come from a recent common ancestor that lived
in Africa. So it's the development of genetic science and our understanding of our own genome in our body that has helped us understand our own ancestry and the fact that we probably all have come from the same continent and have an interconnectedness that theories prior to the 80s and 90s would not have found.
Yeah, exactly. And well, if we think about prior to the genetic data that was available, we have to remember this is a pretty recent field. The human genome was only first sequenced in 2003, the full genome. And prior to that, a lot of the hypotheses and arguments that were being, you know, taking place around this were really, really based on fossil data.
Interesting.
And a lot of the fossil data over the last million years was pretty sparse. There are a lot of sites and fossils from different places around the world, but it was really difficult to know how to really connect them all.
Yeah. And how did they fit together?
Yeah, and you could tell a lot of stories that tried to connect them, and it was hard to kind of distinguish between, you know, whether this hypothesis was supported or that hypothesis. So genetics really came in and helped solidify
that. How did those bones relate to these bones over here? And were these bones connected at some point in our lineage and ancient history?
Yeah, exactly.
But the genome sort of blew all the bones out of the water and decided, hey, here's a much more scientific approach to our own ancestry.
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly. I think there's a lot of value to the fossil record. What you really get from a fuller understanding is really gained by combining different what we call lines of evidence.
So you
have the line of evidence from the fossil data, and you have different lines of evidence from genetic data, and you try to synthesize these to tell a story that fits the observations that you see in the genetics and in the fossil and archaeological sites.
And this is the scientific method where you are substantiating a hypothesis until it is disproven, and then you find another hypothesis that works better, and you use all the evidence that is available to try to make that work or to try to disprove it. And so right now we have a hypothesis about our where we all come from that has yet to be disproven, that we haven't been able to find a fault in.
Yeah, well, I think one of the leading hypothesis or the big picture of the recent African origins is I think on pretty solid ground.
Yeah. It sounds like it's probably most likely not going to be disproved.
I don't think so. No.
But I think what most people think about when it comes to genetics is the ancestry, 23andMe, taking a swab in your mouth and sending it off and finding out How does something like that fit into some of the research that you've doing? How can I better understand the work that you've put into ancient ancestry and my understanding of it?
Yeah, so the science behind 23andMe or Ancestry DNA, it's not all that different from what we do as geneticists, you know. And
interesting.
You know, we're taking sequencing data from individuals who have volunteered or been recruited to be in studies. And you try to learn about shared ancestry among the individuals that you've sequenced. And so if you've sent in your saliva off to 23andMe and you get back some genetic information about, mm-hmm. you know, you'll see who you're related to. If your siblings or your closely related cousins have also taken the test, you can find them through the shared bits of DNA that you've co-inherited from the same shared genetic ancestor. Now, if you zoom out a little bit, you can do the same sort of thing by connecting more distantly related individuals, or even what we would consider unrelated individuals. Because if you go back far enough in time, you will find a common ancestor. We're all related by a common ancestor. So it's just trying to piece together what were the bits of DNA, those little tiny bits of DNA that are connecting different individuals. How far back in time do you have to go to find those common ancestors?
But we're all connected at some level.
We're all connected, yeah.
And that is the human evolution, is that at some degree, mm-hmm. we all have this connection. Tell me a little bit, Aaron Ragsdale, about your research and what you have set out to find and what some of your discoveries were.
Yeah, so the setup for this question was, okay, we know that humans evolved within Africa. We're an African species. And it was only relatively recently in our history that we expanded outside of Africa, within the last 50 to 100,000 years. So what was happening in those preceding, you know, from around 1 million years to 100,000 years ago, which this is, you know, something that's often been called the muddle in the middle. I love that term because it just captures it perfectly. This is the middle Pleistocene, this period, and the muddle refers to this complete unknown of which fossils are actually representative of our ancestors. Huh. Where did the populations live that actually gave rise to us all today? Was it a single population? Were they multiple populations that contributed to present day people? How were they connected? Did they migrate across the continent? And so these were the kind of the basic questions that we were setting out to answer. Can we test competing hypotheses about, you know, who and where, who were our ancestors, where did they live, how are they connected, in using the genetic data of people living today from kind of populations living across the African continent and around the world.
Prior to your research, was there some idea that we had not found a part of our human ancestry that we figured was part of evolution, that there was this ghost species somewhere inside that we needed to discover in order to put it all together?
Yeah, this is also an interesting backstory to this, and this is that prior to around 2010, we didn't know that Neanderthals had actually contributed to our DNA. And I think it's pretty well accepted now that Neanderthals have contributed a small portion, you know, on the order of 1 or a few percent at most.
They're connected to us too.
But we thought for a long time that they were a separate species.
Yep. We had nothing to do with them.
We evolved in isolation. We completely replaced them without, you know, absorbing any of their DNA. But when the Neanderthal genome was first sequenced, this was around 2008, 2009, 2010, it became really apparent that we actually do share, you know, you wouldn't find it in a 23andMe analysis, but you'd be able to find little bits of DNA carried by especially non-African individuals, so Eurasian individuals, who have inherited some portion of their small bits of fragments of DNA from the Neanderthal lineage as well. And so this question about ghost adamant, this kind of helped to explain some of the conundrums that you see
in the muddle in the middle.
Yeah, some of it. And then it kind of became a little bit in vogue to evoke these long diverged ancestral lineages that were isolated for a long time and then recontacted with humans, and to explain some of the patterns of the genetic variation that we see. And so when you look at genomes of African individuals, you see kind of similar like parallel, not exactly the same signatures, but similar types of signatures, where it looks like maybe there was a long diverged lineage that also contributed to populations living in Africa today.
Sure.
And so there was kind of this parallel. You take this analogy of the Neanderthal introgression. Introgression just means kind of mixture from a long diverged lineage.
Being connected to us.
Yeah. And you kind of map that story onto these other groups that also have similar signatures in their DNA and try to tell a story kind of through analogy, I would say. But unlike the story with Neanderthals, where we have their genome and we can actually confirm, we can look at the actual segments of DNA and match them up. We can say this piece on this segment of this chromosome, we can tell that it was inherited from Neanderthals because you share mutations with Neanderthals at those sites.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we don't have the equivalent DNA from a supposed long diverged population within Africa that might kind of by analogy also contribute to the human gene pool.
So this would be the mystery.
This is the mystery. So that's why it's called a ghost population, because it's not a living population, and it's not a population that we have a fossil of or that we could sequence the DNA of. And so it's a hypothesized, it's kind of a construct to try to explain the patterns and
to fill in the unknown right now.
The unknown.
There's a blank there. Mm-hmm. But then Aaron Ragsdale, your research goes in and says maybe this ghost population never existed at all.
Yeah, and we looked at this problem and we thought, well, Africa is a large continent, but we also know that people probably moved around a lot like people move around today.
Sure.
People move around and interact with each other. It's going to be difficult to have populations that are living kind of as neighbors, but be isolated for many hundreds
of
thousands
of years. We're a social species.
Yeah, we're social.
We like to get out.
We move around and we interact. Right, exactly.
That story makes sense to me. Yeah. I understand that story as just a part of the human condition, that we are interconnected and we seek that connection. And so the idea that we would be neighbors but not actually hang out together, well, that might be part of the internet age, but that's probably not part of our ancient history.
Yeah, probably not.
So what did your research begin to uncover when it came to closing the gaps and solving this mystery?
Yeah, so we tested these competing hypotheses about whether you needed a model that had isolation between groups and then recontact, kind of the story of Neanderthals and humans, or if a story of a history of what we would call population structure. So it's not a single population that is, you know, randomly mating, but you have geographic structure, but that geographic structure is connected by ongoing migration or ongoing what we call gene flow between the resident populations of the time. They're connected. You know, you might have some periods of fragmentation, but you have also these periods of merging, of coalescence, of mixing. And we found that a model where you include ongoing migration between at least two, possibly more populations across the continent, that does a better job of explaining the patterns of genetic variation that we see in not just African populations today, but populations around the world, given that we all share that common history, because this is prior to the expansion of humans around the globe.
So here, as I'm listening to you, Aaron, explain your research, what I'm hearing is we had this ghost population that helped explain a mystery in our human evolution, and you looked at human social interaction and the lack of isolation and how populations would mate and meet and come together and then fall apart, and how that could help explain, without any ghost population, our human evolution and where we all are today and how we all go back to the same ancestral lineage.
Yeah, yeah. And so what you find is you have, probably that's, in hindsight, not that surprising, you have people living across a large geographic range, but they're connected.
Well, there might be mountains between us, but sooner or later, somebody's going to climb that mountain and make it to the other side. There might be lakes or oceans between us, but somebody's going to sail them and go see who's over there.
There are a lot of generations that over this time period. We're not talking just a handful of generations. These are hundreds of thousands of years. This is many thousands of generations. And people can move incredible distances over this amount of time. And so it's really not surprising that we would have connection between
individuals. How come nobody thought of this before you, Aaron Ragsdale?
Well, people have thought about this.
But you
people
were able to look at the science
we're
and
just
substantiate
now,
it.
We're just now getting the genetic data to test these models.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so what has the reaction been like so far of your research, Aaron?
I think it's been well accepted. Yeah. I think there have been follow-up studies that have used genetic data from different populations that that have corroborated these findings. And I think it's been fairly well accepted among other fields as well, like paleoanthropology and among archaeologists. You find there's kind of remember what I was talking about, these multiple lines of evidence. Mm-hmm. You have the emerging of technologies like stoneworking technologies and tools, mm-hmm. that look like they also, you had this cultural evolution and technological evolution that also was kind of in concert, where you looked at different places across the continent and you would find kind of concurrent evolution of technological advances, like techniques for flaking a stone or something like
everything
that.
Everything
right?
through the and it, and different sciences seems mm-hmm. to substantiate this, the research and mm-hmm. your findings in your work.
Yeah, you had cultural connections, social connections, technological art connections, and also genetic connections, I think.
What's it like to change science, as you know, Aaron? It's kind of, I mean, the scientific understanding, yeah. And you are now a part of our evolving understanding of human evolution. That's got to be a little weird. Right?
It's incredibly exciting to be in this field, and yeah. it's not like I wouldn't go as far to say as we're coming along and busting open the field or something like that. This is in concert with a lot of different collaborators and colleagues across population genetics, across paleoanthropology. It's kind of an ongoing dialogue among a lot of different researchers on this topic, and kind of collectively coming to a better understanding of our own evolutionary history.
So what's next in this dialogue? We'll ask when we continue with our guest, Aaron Ragsdale, assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, taking a look at his research and how it's changing our understanding of human evolution. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on WPR News. Larry's back tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in today. And tomorrow on this show, the blood test that is identifying Alzheimer's disease, how to best talk to someone who has dementia, and also how to take the best care of your mouth, all coming up tomorrow starting at 11 with Larry on The Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're talking to Aaron Ragsdale, assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. His research is helping to evolve what we understand of human evolution and how interconnected each and every one of us actually are if you go back far enough. And one of those interconnections now includes, as we understand it, thanks to our advancing genetic science, is through Neanderthals, Aaron. And this still kind of blows my mind because it's not what I learned back in science when I was studying science back before, you know, back a long time ago now. So the story of Neanderthals and how we fit into that, share a little bit of that with us.
Yeah, so as I was speaking to you just a few minutes ago, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't know that there was a connection between humans and Neanderthals. So probably many of the listeners, you know, in school, you would learn these were divergent lineages, and they went extinct, and then we outcompeted them or something like that, right?
Right.
And now it seems pretty well. It seems clear that we didn't just replace them, but we did something like absorb them.
Interesting.
And it wasn't a one-off thing. There's relatively recent, just within the last year or two, research that shows that there were probably more than just a single episode of connection. So Neanderthals and humans diverged around 500, 600, 700,000 years ago initially. So that's when their common ancestor was. And then even 5 years ago, we thought that they were completely isolated from humans until around 50 or 60,000 years ago, when our own species expanded and moved around the globe, encountered Neanderthals on the way, and absorbed those resident populations into our own. And that's how we would have inherited those genetic components from Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. Instead, it seems that there's been ongoing. It's probably related to climate, to the glaciation cycles, and when regions of the world were amenable for humans to move across them.
When they were forced to move.
Or even just when a desert turned more green and you could cross hundreds of miles instead of being more isolated. So there are climatic events that...
The way the world changes defines what our behavior.
And so there would be periods when humans could expand outside of, Homo sapiens could expand outside of Africa. And then whenever they did that, they would find other hominin or human-like populations, including Neanderthals, including Denisovans. If you've heard that name, that's a sister branch to Neanderthals that lived in East Asia.
So instead of a common ancestor with Neanderthals, we're talking common ancestors, and that number may range.
Well, you have, instead of isolation for many hundreds of thousands of years, you probably just kind of like this story that we were telling within Africa, within our own species of movement and connection. It's probably a very similar story with Neanderthals. It looks like Neanderthals actually inherited 5 or 10% of human DNA.
Interesting.
A couple hundred thousand years ago from a human early Homo sapiens population that left Africa, didn't actually establish there as they're not the ancestors of humans living outside of Africa today, but they were absorbed by Neanderthal populations. And so if you look at Neanderthal DNA, you kind of find the mirror image. You know, we have some of the Neanderthal DNA from us absorbing some of those populations, and the vice versa. Neanderthals, if you were to sequence them, they would have some human DNA from absorbing some of those early excursions outside of Africa. And this probably happened not just once, not just twice, but probably whenever there was the opportunity for people to move, because that's what people do.
Periods of isolation, periods of connection, and over hundreds of thousands of years, this could have happened any number of hundreds of times.
Could have happened many times. And so you get this, the analogy that a lot of people like to use is one of a braided stream. So you have kind of this, if you think about evolution as a flowing of water, you have a braided stream where you have splits mm-hmm. in the waterway that come back together and split mm-hmm. again and come back together. And every time you have those comings together, you have mixture and then you split again. And so genetics get shuffled around during those periods. And then you can kind of reconstruct the events of when those mixtures happen by looking at the DNA of people living
thinking
today.
Of our evolution like a roiling river that goes into tributaries and separates and reconnects, and mm-hmm. when it does, it's a little bit different than when it first split off, and mm-hmm. it's still moving today. David and Shorewood emailed to ask if the genetic material from the early finds are adequate to place them relative to each other, or is that really old artifact still a mystery? Are there genetic materials from the early finds that are adequate to place them relative to each other?
If I understand, so early finds meaning the older fossils. So there's probably a lot of people have heard of the ancient DNA revolution, where we're able to now essentially drill bones and get DNA from people who lived hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years ago. That depends a lot on the conditions that the fossil was stored in or in the ground. You know, mm-hmm. cooler, drier climates are going to preserve DNA much better than hotter climates or wetter climates. And so we don't, and you can imagine why that's a challenge within the African continent, because it's a hotter place than, you know, the Tibetan Plateau or Northern Europe, where we've been able to get DNA from Neanderthals that lived 50 to 100,000 years ago. In Africa, we don't have ancient DNA beyond a few thousand years.
So that would be a challenge.
So it's challenging. So even though we have some fossils that we would really love DNA from them, there's just no DNA. It's all been degraded due to the conditions that the fossils were in.
Aaron Rex,
I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, it helps me understand your work, but where does your work go from here? What questions do you still have about our evolution, and where will your work take you next?
Yeah, so this is, well, there are a lot of ways.
You got a lot of questions.
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions. Whenever you do this, you kind of uncover more questions than as you answer. Yeah. I'd really love to be able. So what we have when we're talking about models of early evolution, these are really quite cartoonish. Like, they're very, we're trying to peer way into the distant past, so we've only been really able to say, like, very blocky, we don't have a very clear picture of exactly when and exactly where individuals lived. I would love to merge the genetic analyses with stuff like climate reconstruction.
Ooh.
to try to actually pinpoint where the ranges of people might have been over different times and try to map the actual genetic history onto a geography.
Interesting.
That would be really exciting, quite challenging.
Yeah.
These models also raise questions about what does trait evolution look like? What does phenotypic evolution look like among the different competing models?
When you say phenotypic?
Yeah, like just, our genomes are encoding everything that makes up us, our bodies, our physiology.
Okay.
And so if you think about how genes are related to, metabolism, whatever physiological trait you're looking at, you can ask how does evolution of these physiological traits depend on what we would call the demographic model that you've hypothesized or inferred, the evolutionary model that you've inferred. And so those are trying to understand how natural selection, how
climate change, trade,
geography, population density, and movement, and our
physiology.
People, how that all relates to.
You're trying to solve it all, Aaron.
Well, little bits and pieces of it.
I hope you can join us again and share your work with us. And I thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Aaron Ragsdale, assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. And again, thank him for joining us. Want to thank our team for making it all so much fun and so easy today. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, our technical director extraordinaire, Jeff Robbins, and of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn sitting in for him today, and you're listening to WPR News.